Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. A little under 2 weeks since she announced her leadership bid, Andrea Leadsom has sensationally quit the race to become Conservative Party leader and Prime Minister of the UK. "We need a new Prime Minister as soon as possible," Leadsom said, adding that she had the support of less than 25% of the parliamentary party. Leadsom backed her lone rival Home Secretary Theresa May, saying she is ideally placed to implement Brexit on the best possible terms for the British people. The country's energy minister faced a series of questions surrounding her resume, in which it was alleged that she embellished her record in the private sector. She was also criticized for an interview with the London Times, where she suggested that being a mother gave her an advantage over May, who does not have children. Leadsom's withdrawal means May is the sole contender to succeed David Cameron as leader of the party and the country. The Home Secretary could become Prime Minister as soon as Monday afternoon unless the party decides to run the contest with the candidate who finished third in the ballot, Justice Minister Michael Gove. However, Gove has just said he does not want to reopen the leadership contest and that May should become leader as quickly as possible. This article posted by Tara John.
For President Barack Obama, the decision to return early from an overseas trip after a series of shocking shootings will prove to be easy compared to his next challenge, comforting an America that has witnessed a rash of shootings. After arriving from Spain late Sunday, Obama will fly Tuesday to Dallas, the scene of the massacre of police officers that, on the heels of two caught-on-video police shootings, has emerged as a tipping point in the national debate about race and justice. Obama is due to deliver remarks at an interfaith memorial service and is expected to meet with victims' families and with local law enforcement officials mourning their own. To some degree, the trip is a familiar ritual for a president who has embarked in recent years on similar consolation missions with relentless frequency. But it's clear that Obama views the moment as distinct. In choosing to deliver a speech rather than a private visit with families, Obama has tasked himself with ministering to Americans as they make sense of a frustrating cloud of issues swirling around the shootings. The president sees delivering this sort of guidance a core part of his leadership, so much so that some of his memorable speeches were in honor of mass shooting victims, including his challenge to protect children from guns in Newtown, Connecticut, "We're Not Doing Enough," and his singing of Amazing Grace after the shooting in a black church in Charleston, South Carolina. But it's far from clear whether these moments fostered movement, either on legislation or race relations, and Obama has had to face the limits of his rhetoric. As he has in the past, Obama will search this week for a way to break through. As he traveled to Poland and Spain last week for meetings with European leaders, the president was publicly working through his thoughts. At times, he acknowledged anger and confusion in the public, and at other times, he seemed to downplay the enormity of events. On the shootings by police of black men in Minnesota and Louisiana, Obama called for more activism and reforms, and he sought to impress upon white Americans what he said he and other African Americans already know: the problem is real. On the shooting in Dallas, Obama cast Micah Johnson, the sniper killed in a standoff with police, as demented and his motives as unknowable. "People should not believe that the act of a troubled individual speaks to some larger political statement across the country," he said. "It doesn't." Obama also pointed to other forces driving discontent at home and in Europe: lone wolf terrorism or economic instability wrought by globalization, and tried to sell his policies aimed at each. The comments highlighted this president's rationality and a tendency to analyze people's fears rather than validate them, both traits that at times have limited his ability to connect. Asked Saturday about rising worries about safety, Obama cited crime statistics. He bluntly dismissed comparisons to the domestic turbulence of the 1960s as overblown. "That's just not true," he said. Obama's remarks also captured the president continuing to try to serve as a bridge builder between white and black Americans, protesters, and police. It's a role that helped catapult him to political stardom, but one he has struggled to inhabit as president during a period of sharp political polarization and continued racial tensions. Still, Obama wasn't about to cede the role this week. White House officials said the decision to trim his trip to Spain by one day was driven in part by not wanting other divisive voices to fill the void left in his absence. On Sunday, a few hours before returning home, Obama tried again to walk a center line as he issued a plea for better understanding between police and demonstrators taking part in the protests across the country. "I'd like all sides to listen to each other," he said. This article posted by Kathleen Hennessy of the Associated Press. No one has to love Paul Feig's new Ghostbusters or even like it. But anyone who continues to stand against it on principle, "My childhood has been defiled. I don't like its stars. The trailer was bad," is an unimaginative schmuck, because Feig's Ghostbusters is its own definitive creature, an affable, inventive riff on Ivan Reitman's proton-packing caper that exists not to score points, but only to make us laugh. For a summer comedy, there's no nobler purpose. Like their 1984 counterparts, the new Ghostbusters, Kristen Wiig's no-nonsense yet vaguely daffy physics whiz Erin, Melissa McCarthy's screwball scientist Abby, Kate McKinnon's deadpan gearhead Jillian, and Leslie Jones's fervent Manhattan history nut Patty are all classic New York City eccentrics who need to find their place in a world of non-believers. Their dim-witted but hunky receptionist, Chris Hemsworth's Kevin, helps out too, but mostly he's just ridiculously enjoyable eye candy, a form of gentle revenge for years of stereotypical sexy secretaries. When Erin, Abby, and Jillian spot their first real ghost, a nutso turn-of-the-century murderess, now a listless, translucent jellyfish of doom, they jump and squeal with delight, a spontaneously girly reaction for which they make no apologies. But later, when the ghostbusting gets tough, after a squadron of nasty ghouls descend upon an unsuspecting Manhattan, they wield their ectoplasm blammers with Rambo-like authority. It's all presented with a wink. There's nothing heavy-spirited or assaultive about this Ghostbusters. Feig, who co-wrote the script with Katie Dippold, The Heat, has clearly taken great care with the movie's tone. It's as delicately balanced as the wings of a spectral butterfly. He honors the spirit of the original. Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, and Annie Potts all have cameos, and a gleaming bronze bust of the late Harold Ramis graces the hallowed halls of Columbia University, where part of that Ghostbusters, like this one, takes place. Yet there's little that's nostalgic, in the musty sense, about Feig's reimagined ghostbusting universe. The movie glows with vitality, thanks largely to the performers, who revel in one another's company, and not in a self-congratulatory Ocean's 12-style, "we're awesome movie stars together" way. Some of their dialogue has a loose, loopy, unscripted vibe, a la Bill Murray's poker-faced asides in the original. When the heroines take time out from their heavy-duty citizen saving for an impromptu Patrick Swayze reverie, they are inviting us right into the crystalline goofiness of the moment. There's visual glory here, too. The finale takes place in a dazzling Times Square mashup of past and present, a place where contemporary digital news tickers share space with ghost embellishments like Regal Shoes, Nathan's, and an RKO National Theater showing Bruce Lee's 1972 Fists of Fury. In one of the most stunning moments, the women face down a phalanx of sinister vintage Macy's parade balloons. Floating along, they're a kiddie nightmare come to life, glowing and gorgeous even as they advance with menacing intent. Their macabre beauty stops the movie for a moment. They've come from the past to shake their fists at the present. Maybe they don't like remakes either, but that's their problem. Happy or not, they're part of the here and now. This is the kind of movie you make when you ain't afraid of no ghosts. This article posted by Stephanie Zakarik. The U.S. women's gymnastics team has a lot to prove next month when the Olympic Games start in Rio. As defending team gold medalists, there's pressure to defend that title. And as the country that's produced the last three all-around champions in a row, there's tremendous expectations to make it a four-peat. That's very likely to happen with three-time world champion Simone Biles now officially on the U.S. team. Biles easily won the two-day Olympic trials in San Jose, California, cementing her reputation as the best gymnast in the world. Biles hasn't lost a major competition since winning the world championships in 2013. Despite an uncharacteristic fall off the beam and a small break on the uneven bars, Biles's high-difficulty routines meant even a few deductions kept her well ahead of her 12 other competitors. As the winner of the Olympic trials event, Biles was the only guaranteed member of the Rio-bound team. The remaining four members were chosen by a selection committee of three: national team coordinator Martha Caroli, Tatiana Perskaya, a women's national team coach, and Taryn Humphrey, the athlete representative. The panel met for nearly half an hour after the trials were completed at the SAP Center to name the remainder of the team. After the agonizing wait, Gabrielle Douglas, reigning Olympic all-around gold medalist from London 2012, learned that she qualified for her second Olympic trip despite coming in seventh at the trials. Her second-place finish behind Biles at last year's World Championships and her experience with Olympic-level competition, particularly on the uneven bars where the U.S. team is weak, however, made up for her trials performance. Her London teammate, Ali Raisman, also earned a second Olympic spot with solid finishes throughout this season. Joining them are first-time Olympians Laurie Hernandez from Old Bridge, New Jersey, and Madison Kosian of Dallas. Hernandez was the surprise standout of the trials with a memorably energetic floor routine and consistent routines on three other events over the two-day competition, making it clear she's ready for a shot at the Olympics. The team is a carefully built group meant to give the U.S. the best chance of defending its team gold. Three gymnasts will compete on each of the four events, and Caroli and the selection committee scrutinized each gymnast's routine to figure out which combination of programs would yield the highest overall score. Biles excels at vault, floor, and balance beam, as does Raisman, while Douglas and Kosian are specialists on the uneven bars, and Hernandez shines on the floor. The team now heads to Houston to the National Training Center for further training, during which Caroli will determine the final lineup of who will compete on which event in Rio. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has long been far more outspoken than her colleagues on the Supreme Court, and she is mincing no words when it comes to a certain presumptive Republican nominee for president. I can't imagine what this place would be. I can't imagine what the country would be with Donald Trump as our president, Ginsburg said in an interview with the New York Times on Sunday. She says her late husband, Martin Ginsburg, who died in 2010, would have declared, "Now it's time for us to move to New Zealand." Unsurprisingly, she hinted at whom she would be voting for in another interview with the Associated Press 2 days ago. "It's likely that the next president, whoever she will be, will have a few appointments to make," she told the AP. Ginsburg, one of Time's 100 most influential people last year, also offered a ringing endorsement of Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee to the top court following Justice Antonin Scalia's death earlier this year. She described him as a super bright and very nice, super prepared and qualified individual who would make a great colleague. She lamented the Republican majority Senate's continued blocking of Garland from consideration and its insistence that the next president, to be elected in November, should be the one to appoint a new Supreme Court justice. "That's their job," Ginsburg said, when asked whether the Senate should give the 63-year-old judge a fair hearing. "There's nothing in the Constitution that says the president stops being president in his last year." In the meantime, Ginsburg said the court deadlocked between four liberal justices and four conservative ones couldn't have done better than it did. She hailed, in particular, landmark decisions on affirmative action and abortion, the latter of which she filed a widely acclaimed concurrent brief on. "I wanted to highlight the point that it was perverse to portray this, the Texas law struck down by the court, as protecting women's health," she told The Times. "Desperate women then would be driven to unsafe abortions." Toward the end of Sunday night's Euro 2016 soccer final between Portugal and France, things got pretty raucous in one part of China's Pearl River Delta. For those who were awake in Macau, at least, Kickoff was at 3 a.m., Portugal's victory was a reminder of a shared history stretching back more than half a millennium. "I don't even know how I feel right now," says an ecstatic Pedro Lemos, 32, shortly after the referee's whistle brings to an end 120 minutes of football that was largely less than thrilling. Until Antonio Eder's precision strike in the 109th minute, the highlight of the match at Paris' Stade de France might have been the comma-tragic moment when a moth fluttered onto the face of a tearful Cristiano Ronaldo, just as the star was coming to the realization that he was injured and would have to be substituted early in one of the biggest games of his career. The quality of play didn't matter for the folks crowded into a Portuguese language institute attached to the pastel-yellow Baroque Portuguese Consulate General building in the historic old town of Macau. Lemos, who plays soccer for a team representing the Portuguese community in Macau, is filled with emotions over the win, he says. Portugal, which was the underdog going into the final against hosts France, had never won a major soccer tournament until Sunday. But Lemos says there's no sense he's missing out by not being home to celebrate the historic win. Macau is a good place for it. The first Portuguese to land in China, Jorge Alvarez, arrived here in 1513. The name Macau is said to be a Portuguese mispronunciation of a Cantonese temple in honor of the goddess of seafarers that sits at the peninsula's rocky tip. The Portuguese ruled here until 1999, when the tiny territory, home now to about 500,000 people, was handed over to mainland China. Lemos, a legal advisor who moved to Macau 3.5 years ago after visiting his brother here, is one of an estimated 8,000 Portuguese expatriates who make up a solid community in the former colony. They came to Macau over other cities for its sense of connection to their homeland, they say, as well as economic opportunity. It helps that Macau is awash with cash from the world's biggest gambling industry, while Portugal has been in an economic crisis since 2010. Pedro Caeiro, 35, arrived 8 months ago to teach Portuguese. There is still interest in the language as it's used in Macau's civil service, and there's a connection between China and the Portuguese-speaking countries, he says in reference to the role Macau plays in China's external trade relations, particularly with commodity-rich Lusophone Angola. Macau's architecture and the art and music scenes give a sense of familiarity, he says. I wouldn't say it feels like home, but there's still a connection, he adds. Pedro Andre, 32, came to Macau 2 years ago to work as a construction engineer. The casinos, which dwarf those in Las Vegas, both physically and in terms of revenues, are rapidly losing steam as a result of a Chinese government crackdown on corruption and capital flight. But there's still work on a raft of massive casino hotels still going up in the area known as the Cotai Strip, he says. After that, who knows, he tells Time. Earlier in Sunday's game, Andre confided that he was pessimistic about his country's chances. They have better players than us, he said, as France, led by possible player of the tournament Antoine Griezmann, began to mount attacks. But as the French continually failed to score, hope started to creep in among the Macau crowd. The Institute laid on beer, the first 4 bottles of Super Bock were free, and Portuguese food. The bifanas, pork chop sandwiches, went down well among the gathered expats. The Macanese, a historic Creole community of Portuguese and Chinese origin, with Goan, Japanese, Malay, and Sinhalese thrown in, and at least one Vietnamese migrant worker who had come to soak up some of the glory. I support Portugal because I like the country, and we have history, says Chow Pak K, 24, a Macau Chinese, and because I like C. Ronaldo, he's very handsome. Chow says although he works as a dealer in one of the casinos, he doesn't usually gamble, but he has put a bet of about $12.50 on Portugal to win, just for fun. When Portugal grab a goal in extra time, the place goes crazy. Most can't quite believe that they are going to defeat France, the hosts, especially after their team's middling performances in the early stages of the tournament. They chant Ronaldo as the injured star takes up a position on the touchline alongside the coach, his influence now limited to the sheer force of his will. At the final whistle, the Portuguese national anthem gets sung. Portugal has waited a long time for this, says João Nonis, the 20-year-old Lisbon native whose family hails from another Portuguese colonial outpost, Guinea-Bissau, came 2 years ago to study English in Macau. Drawn by its combination of historic ties to Portugal and position on the doorstep of a rising China. But as the sun comes up, ushering in another steamy day in Macau, his mind is on the unlikely rise of his soccer heroes. This is something really special, he says. I can't believe it. This article posted by Simon Lewis in Macau. Officers made dozens of arrests in Louisiana's capital on a long, hot weekend of protests over the killings of black people by police, with demonstrations around the country highlighted by attempts to block some major interstates. Police in riot gear managed to keep a group of protesters late Sunday in Baton Rouge from entering a major artery, Interstate 110 in Baton Rouge, thwarting a tactic that social justice activists have increasingly tried in some major cities to protest the deaths. Tensions between black citizens and police have risen palpably since last week's killings of Alton Sterling in the Louisiana capital, Baton Rouge, and Philando Castile in Minnesota by white officers, and a retaliatory attack on white police by a black sniper in Dallas that killed 5 officers and wounded several others, including 2 civilians. More than 1,000 people left a Black Lives Matter rally in Memphis, Tennessee, and occupied a key bridge over the Mississippi River on Sunday night, temporarily blocking all traffic on Interstate 40. Elsewhere, hundreds answered a call by that group to march onto I-264 in Portsmouth, Virginia, marooning motorists for hours inside the area's downtown tunnel. On the West Coast, hundreds of people poured into the streets in Southern California late Sunday night, shutting down a major intersection and briefly blocking traffic on the 405 freeway while peacefully protesting the recent fatal police shootings of black men. Authorities told the Los Angeles Times there were no arrests and no reports of violence. In recent days, demonstrators also tried but failed to block highways in Atlanta and Columbia, South Carolina, while in San Francisco, police managed to keep them off the Bay Bridge. Several hundred people blocked an area of Interstate 94 in Minneapolis-St. Paul on Saturday. Leaders in some local communities have sought to discourage the traffic-blocking tactics. While I appreciate the peaceful intent of this weekend's rallies, I'd ask that we not put our fellow citizens or law enforcement at risk, which is exactly what attempting to block a highway does, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley said in a statement. In Louisiana, some 2,000 people rallied peacefully Sunday outside the Capitol building, State Police Major Doug Kane said. They didn't have any problems out there. They seemed to be very organized and peaceful, Kane said. By Sunday night, a few hundred people aimed for an on-ramp of Interstate 110 in Baton Rouge. After a lengthy standoff, more police in full riot gear moved in, pinning some of the protesters as others fled. Some 30 to 40 people were taken into custody for trying to block a highway, Sheriff's spokeswoman Casey Rayborn Hicks said. That brought arrests to more than 160, by latest count, in recent days in the Louisiana capital. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said at a late weekend news conference that he was very proud of his state's law enforcement response. Flanked by officers in uniform, Edwards said he didn't believe using riot gear to push protesters away from highway ramps was overly aggressive. I can assure everyone we are hearing the protesters, the governor added at the news conference. We are listening to their voices, but I'm especially gratified that our citizens here in Louisiana, to a very large degree, have decided to protest in a constructive and peaceful manner. A Baton Rouge police spokesman, Sergeant Don Coppola, had blamed the large number of arrests on outside agitators. Police also confiscated 3 rifles, 3 shotguns, and 2 pistols during that protest, he wrote in an email. But most of those detained live in Louisiana, the Baton Rouge and New Orleans areas mostly, and faced a single charge of obstructing a highway, the sheriff's spokeswoman Hicks said. Some of the recent demonstrations in Baton Rouge began at the convenience store where 37-year-old Alton Sterling was killed while 2 police subdued him. The U.S. Justice Department has launched a civil rights investigation. This article posted by Michael Kunzelman and Rebecca Santana of the Associated Press.
The founder of St. Paul's Black Lives Matter chapter denounced the violent protesters who blocked a major interstate and attacked police officers Saturday night in the Twin Cities, saying they did a disservice to the officers trying to maintain order and that their actions did nothing to further the group's goals. Rashad Turner, who leads Black Lives Matter in St. Paul, tells Time that he blames much of the violence on people who he says weren't from the area. "There were people outside of the community I didn't recognize," he says. "They were doing stupid stuff, and it's something we don't tolerate." More than 100 people were arrested late Saturday and into Sunday after protesters marched from the Minnesota governor's mansion toward I-94, which connects St. Paul and Minneapolis. The protests followed days of largely peaceful demonstrations after the death last week of Philando Castile, who was killed by police officers following a traffic stop in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, a suburb of St. Paul. Video of the shooting's aftermath was posted to Facebook Live by his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds. On Saturday around 9 p.m., protesters began blocking traffic in both directions along I-94, leading to a standoff between demonstrators and St. Paul police. 21 officers were injured after demonstrators set off fireworks, threw bricks and bottles from pedestrian overpasses, and wielded rebar from a nearby construction site. The occupation and shutting down of Interstate 94 last night were unlawful and extremely dangerous, Governor Mark Dayton said in a statement. "I urge all Minnesotans to remain calm and peaceful during this very difficult time." At a news conference Sunday morning, St. Paul police held up a bent and damaged police badge to illustrate the violence. One of the officers who was hit with concrete suffered broken vertebrae, police said later on Sunday. "I just can't believe this occurred," said Todd Axtell, St. Paul's chief of police. "This is just something that doesn't happen in St. Paul." Critics of the Black Lives Matter movement say that the group's rhetoric and tone have encouraged violence against police in St. Paul and around the country. Turner says he was in regular contact with the St. Paul police chief to help authorities respond to violent protesters. He also praised the police response, saying they showed great restraint and did their best to de-escalate the situation. "People are angry," Turner says. "People are emotional, but we would never encourage violence. There are other ways to channel that anger." He described one incident in which a large chunk of concrete was thrown from a pedestrian overpass, hitting an officer in the chest. "I heard it clear as day from 500 feet away," Turner says. "That type of stuff we can't have. Violence is never going to get us anywhere." This article posted by Josh Sanborn in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Three new reasons those maddening airline fees are here to stay. Passengers endured another unlovely airport cattle call this July 4th weekend, complete with an onslaught of those pesky fees for checking a bag, carrying one aboard, changing flights, extra legroom seating, pillows, or snacks. The bad news for thrifty travelers? Airline fees are not going away, at least for some time. Like bamboo, they are ever-spreading and very hard to eradicate. U.S. airlines, lately profitable amid lower fuel costs and better economic conditions, insist on maintaining and further expanding the array of fees, which bolsters their bottom lines. A legislative attempt to staunch the fee flood has foundered because of partisan discord on Capitol Hill, helping the airline's cause, and many passengers have grown used to the fees. 5 to 6 million people travel by air every year, says Douglas Kidd, executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. When airlines raise their fees, that's a lot of money. Fees began expanding in earnest around 2008 as a way of coping with surging fuel costs and the Great Recession. Airlines, the very picture of a cyclical industry, were suffering then. But nowadays, they are enjoying lush profits. Part of that is the fee explosion. Baggage fees for 25 of the largest airlines grew 7.4% last year to $3.8 billion, U.S. Transportation Department figures show. If the economy slumps again, fees will act as a cushion for the carrier's finances. Passengers' finances are another matter. At $25 per checked bag, a family of four with two bags each would lay out $200. here's why these extra charges will not go away anytime soon. Fees keep proliferating. The trend is toward more of them, not fewer, which complicates the task of fee-foes. The more bamboo to cut down, the tougher the job. Think there's nothing more to impose a fee on? Try connecting flights. Time was you'd pay a single fee to check your bag for a two-part trip. When your luggage got transferred for the second leg to a different aircraft or even a different airline, a routine industry convenience called through check-in. Say you're flying from New York to London on British Airways, then switch planes for London to Vienna on Air Berlin. Not so much anymore. British Airways, American Airlines, and their alliance partners in June started to limit your ability to pay that single bag transfer fee. For many carriers now, when you change planes, you must collect your checked bags, go through security again, and pay a second time for the next leg of your trip. This policy doesn't apply if you booked both flights on the same ticket. The story is different, though, should you split the trip into two tickets. Perhaps because for your trip's second leg you found a better fare on another airline or you use frequent flyer miles. Then get ready to lug your bags around the layover terminal and pay twice. Among its partners in the 15-airline One World Alliance, British Airways appears to be the most restrictive on through check-in. A passenger with BA, the second-largest transatlantic carrier, is even out of luck when booking a seat on a second BA flight or with fellow members of One World, a system designed to ease multi-airline bookings. American Airlines, the largest global carrier and a One World member, indicates in a memo on its website that it will keep on honoring the customer courtesy for other One World airlines and affiliates, but not for anyone else. BA and One World were not the first to crack down on bag transfers. It has been standard policy on the Star Alliance, which includes United Airlines and Lufthansa, since March 2015. The new limits are needed because, a One World spokesman says, multiple tickets render planning for making connections impossible. Logistical snafus result from separate bookings, he says, harming baggage delivery and transfers. Although it's unclear how many people will run afoul of the new luggage regimen, the number is certainly large. A lot of business flyers need to exchange tickets when their plans change, and that happens all the time, says Charles Locha, chairman of Travelers United, a consumer group. And frequent flyer users are huge. Congressional gridlock. Two Democratic senators tried in the spring to push through a measure that would block airlines from charging unreasonable fees. They complained that over 5 years, three domestic airlines had boosted bag fees by 33% and cancellation fees by 33%. Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut and Ed Markey of Massachusetts tried to get their proposal attached to the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill. No dice. The Senate Commerce Committee voted down their bid along party lines. Committee Chairman John Thune, a South Dakota Republican, argued that it's not up to the federal government to determine when fees are unreasonable. In fairness, the legislation that emerged from Congress had one consumer-friendly feature. It required that airlines must refund bag fees if luggage is delayed for more than 24 hours. But any stronger federal role on the fee issue likely awaits the Democrats winning both houses of Congress this fall, an iffy proposition. Following the defeat of their fee restriction measure, Blumenthal and Markey called on 12 major U.S. airlines to cease charging bag fees this summer amid fears of long lines at airport security gates. Crowds of people humping luggage through TSA points rather than checking the bags would slow down the lines, they warned. Although the Memorial Day and July 4th weekend rushes didn't produce all the bottlenecks that some feared, the summer travel season is hardly over. The airlines didn't bow to the senator's wishes on a summer fee hiatus. Grudging public acceptance of the fees. While the flying public obviously dislikes paying the extra for things that used to be free or low cost, a recent survey by J.D. Power & Associates finds that flyers' ire over fees has diminished. The research group says satisfaction rates with airlines rose significantly, in large part due to lower airfares. Another study estimates that airplane tickets will be down 12% this summer compared to the summer before. That should turn down the heat on the industry over the fee issue. Although passengers can mostly thank lower fuel costs for the fare reductions, fees play a role. Airlines for America, the industry's lobbying group, commissioned a poll that found 67% of flyers preferred what it calls the a la carte pricing model, that is, fees, if it led to lower fares. For example, says a spokeswoman for the organization, those who don't check a bag aren't paying for something they're not using, which helps airlines to keep base fares low. But what about when fuel prices rise? From 2011 to 2015, fuel costs for airlines were halved. A fuel increase would put upward pressure on fares, which could heighten passengers' irritation over the fees and could give new impetus to fee opponents in Washington and elsewhere. This article posted by Larry Light. Black Lives Matter protest in New York attracts new people. In the 2 years since Michael Brown was killed by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, there have been dozens of Black Lives Matter demonstrations in nearly every city in the country. But for many of the protesters who flooded the streets of downtown Manhattan Saturday night, this protest was their first. "This is the new civil rights movement, and I wanted to be a part of it," says Latoya Francis, a 16-year-old student at Polytechnic High School in Brooklyn. "Social media has made it so much easier to feel connected to the victims. We're way more angry this time around." Francis and his friends came to demonstrate for the first time on Saturday, horrified by the videotaped killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile last week, and undeterred by the violence against police officers at another protest in Dallas. "I want to be more than just an internet activist," explains Francis' friend Bryce Edwards, 15. Francis and Edwards joined hundreds of other protesters for a march through downtown Manhattan Saturday night, guarded by lines of police officers who formed a human barricade to protect and contain the demonstration. The New York City event was less eventful than other demonstrations this weekend, including the Baton Rouge protest where Black Lives Matter leader DeRay McKesson was arrested, and the protesters seemed largely respectful of the police officers on duty, especially in light of the shootings in Dallas. But the killings of Sterling and Castile seem to have electrified a new generation of Black Lives Matter protesters, including many teenagers who would have been too young to demonstrate when the movement first formed 2 years ago. "It starts with one step. That's how you get things done," says Brian Buchanan, also 16, who wants to be an electrical engineer when he grows up. He condemns the violence in Dallas, but he's concerned the outrage over the murder of the police officers will overshadow the outrage at what he sees as pervasive racial injustice. "The shooting in Dallas is a tragedy, but so is coming out of your own house and not feeling safe to walk down the street," he says. Buchanan was there with his sisters Brianna, 21, and Acacia, 13. They said this was their first protest because their parents hadn't allowed them to come before. "But this time was different. I can't worry every time he walks out the door that he won't come home," Brianna says of her brother. Other first-time demonstrators said they felt exhausted by what they saw as the endless stream of police killings. Many said they were joining the movement not out of excitement, but out of fatigue. "I'm tired," says Essence Dixon, 20. "I'm tired of wondering what hate did you have in your heart that you had to kill that man. I'm tired of seeing our people slaughtered all over town," says her friend Xavier Brown, 19, also a student and first-time demonstrator. "If I don't stand up, who will?" "It hurts re-watching those videos and knowing no conviction will happen," says Aquana Hines, 20, who was there with Brown and Dixon. "It hurts. It makes you cry." And while every protester condemned the shootings in Dallas, many voiced concern that the attack would complicate the narrative, making it more difficult for Black Lives Matter activists to effectively condemn police violence. Others were angry that many Americans didn't start paying attention to the violence until police officers were dying. "It's scary how that spoke to them versus how many black people died," says Hines. "We've had 5 cops and 500 black people." She was referring to the Washington Post's tally of police shooting deaths, which records all the people of any race shot and killed by police officers so far in 2016. So far, 511 have been killed. "They had a decision to become a police officer," says her friend Essence, "but I didn't choose which skin color I have. Alton Sterling didn't, and Philando Castile didn't." This article posted by Charlotte Alter.
A bullfighter in Spain was fatally gored on live television Saturday in the country's first death of a professional matador in the ring in more than 3 decades. Victor Barrio, 29, died after an 1,166-pound bull flipped him and gored him in the thigh and in the chest, which penetrated a lung and his aorta, the Associated Press reports. My condolences to the family and colleagues of Victor Barrio, the deceased bullfighter this evening in Teruel. Rest in peace, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy tweeted. Barrio was the first professional matador to die during a bullfight in Spain since 1985, when 21-year-old José Cubero Hijo from France was fatally gored in Madrid, according to the AP. This article posted by Melissa Chan. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.